Welcome to the Art of Authenticity. Today we have Coot Blackstone joining us. I am so honored to have him on the show as the author of the best-selling novel, You Are the One. He is also a transformational leader. He offers a different approach that he created, a process that liberates the individual and the true self at the core, and then pushes those gifts outward into the universe. He realized that the outside-in approach doesn't work for personal development and replaced it with an inside-out approach. This helps the individual get in touch with who they really are, the process of breaking free so they can live, give, and share their truest expression of self. This is what Coot calls liberated living. Today, we talked about authenticity. Coot uses some of the same terminology that I feel strongly, peeling back the layers of self, how we're just energetic, beautiful beings from birth, and what happens, how those layers get added on, how you can remove them, how to get back, step up, and rise up into the life that you were meant to live. I hope you enjoyed today's show. I loved chatting with him, and I know that you're going to be as inspired as I was. Thank you so much for listening. Welcome to today's episode. Today we have Coot Blackstone joining us. Hey, Coot, how are you? Thank you so much for coming on.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. I said briefly before we jumped on how excited I am to chat with you. So many of the ideas in your book are so powerful and interesting, and I know everybody is going to get a ton of value. But before we jump in, your backstory is just tremendous. I thought if you could walk us through, I know you grew up in London and your father founded a church, and then you read some Krishnamurti and it was a turning point. Mm-hmm. Can you take us back through the story a little bit of what led you to this journey?
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Ghana, West Africa. My father's from Ghana. My mother's Japanese. I grew up in London. We had to leave Ghana because of a coup. They were, overthrowing the president. We ended up in London and stayed there. And my first memory as a young boy was really two things. I remember growing up with this deep calling to serve humanity, this deep sense that I was here to make a difference in some way. And that was a burning desire that's never left me. But the other thing that also set the foundation, and I think the trajectory for my life, was being around age six, age seven, being a chubby kid lost in the crowd in Ghana. And I remember seeing a crippled woman crawling on the floor, and she was crippled and she was crawling and people were walking all around her. And she picked up the sand that this man walked on, wiped it on her face and stood up. And you could say it was a miracle. And so week after week, I grew up seeing blind people see and deaf people hear and people stand up have wheelchairs. And so basically the man whose sand she picked up was my father. And yeah, I remember another memory, literally seeing him look at a woman in a wheelchair and say, why are you in this wheelchair? Stand up. I see who you are. Stand up. And so I grew up in this environment of, you could say, miracles and possibility, where there were no limits on what was possible. Yeah. And so age eight, I started to speak in my father's churches. My father had approximately 300 churches in Ghana, West Africa, and one in London, and was a very spiritual, mystical kind of guy. And the reason we had to leave Ghana was because he was the spiritual teacher advisor to the president at the time, and they killed the president. They were looking for my father, and my father happened to be in London, so he couldn't come back. So my mother and I were smuggled out of the country.
Oh my goodness. And yeah. You said 300 churches he ran. That's...
Yeah, 300 and, hundreds of thousands of followers. Just huge amounts of followers, especially in the height in the 80s. It was a massive operation. And so age eight, I started speaking. And age 14, I was given the mandate to take over my father's, you could say, organization. And there was a lot of hope and expectation put on me to take over and be the successor. And that was my path. My life was pretty much set out for me. Yet, honestly, I knew I was meant to make a difference, but deep down, something didn't feel right. Deep down, I knew that I have a different destiny. But, being 14, wanting the love of your father and not wanting to rock the boat, not wanting to upset anyone, and all these hopes and dreams of so many people on my shoulders, I didn't say anything. And I kind of went through with the whole ordination and became a minister and a lot of pressure. And I knew something was off. I knew something wasn't aligned. And I think many times we have this inkling, we have this knowing, we have this sensing, we have this intuition. Something's not quite right here. And yet we don't listen to it. We don't honor it. We don't follow through. So it took me about, and honestly, I wanted my father's love, his acceptance. I didn't want to be outcast. I didn't want to piss anyone off, rock the boat. Right. So for about 4 years, it took me about 4 years to really muster up the courage to, you could say, face my father and speak my truth. And one of the things that really helped me was Jay Krishnamurti's book, books. And I read his books. I became obsessed with spirituality and personal growth and really trying to understand who are we and why we're here and the nature of life. And I read everything from the Eastern mystics to the pop psychology to people like Wayne Dyer, Marianne Williamson to, you name it. I literally read everyone. So one day I came across Krishnamurti's book and I could really relate to his life. He was being groomed to take over this organization. And then, he came to an epiphany and left everything behind.
Oh, is that right? I did not know that part. I was wondering why Krishnamurti when you read all those different people. But so his life really spoke to you in a similar way.
His life spoke to me because I could relate. Him and his brother, they were found, by Theosophists, and they were being groomed and to take over. And he was being groomed to be the world teacher. And I could so relate to some of this, his life story. And then he left everything, dissolved everything, walked away from everything, you could say. And when you hear truth, when you feel something, sometimes it just hits you in the belly, in the gut, so to speak. And when I read that, I knew what I had to do. It was like one of those, oh my God, moments. It's like, oh my, I wish I didn't know the truth, but now I know. And it hit me. And it was so strong that I knew that there was no turning back. And I was about 14, 15.
That's very young. And I mean, so a lot of people have that moment of truth, but then they immediately turn back to the thoughts in their head and they say why they can't do it. But you felt very motivated towards this.
Yeah. I think we have this inkling, this knowing, but we lie to ourselves. And I think that's one of the things that keeps us stuck. We lie to ourselves. We rationalize, we pretend. We're like, well, no, this job isn't so bad. No, what I'm doing is okay. No, this thing, this behavior isn't costing me that much. No, this relationship, it's okay. I can work with it. So there's this way we're constantly lying to ourselves, rationalizing, because sometimes we're afraid if I tell the truth to myself, what will be the consequence?
Yes.
What will happen? I may have to give up my job. I might have to leave my relationship. I might have to fill in the blank. So I think it can be a little scary sometimes to acknowledge what we know. So we distract ourselves, we busy ourselves, we social media ourselves, we avoid, we numb, just so we don't have to feel the truth. And I think that creates a tremendous disconnection and pain inside to know and not follow that and not live that. And then we end up living a life that sometimes isn't fully an authentic expression of who we are and of our hearts. So I felt it at a very young age, and I tried to numb it for about 4 years. And when I read Krishnamurti's book, it was like an explosion. And when I was 17, 18, I finally mustered the courage to have the conversation with my father, because when I looked at my life and I looked at if I followed his vision for my life and the expectations of all these people and not wanting to disappoint them, if I followed that path, I've literally felt my soul dying. I felt like I was committing suicide for my soul, so to speak. And there was so much pain and there was so much hurt there. Feeling the possibility, and I realized I might become successful by everyone else's standards, for everyone else, but if I don't have myself, then I have nothing. And so that pain and the realization of the reality of that path was so strong that it kind of inspired me to go into the unknown and follow the calling of my soul, even though I didn't know exactly where it was leading me. I just knew I was being guided to America and a whole different destiny. And cut long story short, won a green card in the lottery. And that was proof for me that whenever we are on point, whenever we are following our deepest truth, our soul's calling, the universe supports us in those moments. And then I came to America with two suitcases, one in the country, showed up with $1,000, with a dream and a vision to inspire people, and went and found teachers, authors, mentors, traveled the world, everywhere from India and Bali and Pan and Israel, and went on pilgrimages to really find out who am I really. And it was really based on all of that inner transformation that I came back to the US and and created a coaching company at the time and working with people in seminars, and things just expanded over the last 14, 15 years.
It's tremendous to come from a space where you're being smuggled out of a country, you know, turning your back on this idea that you may lose the love of your parents and your father by facing your own truth and persevering. Mm-hmm. You start your book with this sentence that really caught my eye. Your book, You Are the One, with a period after every word. And you say, no one's coming, no parents, no government. Why did you start there?
I think many of us, I see many of us working with clients and what have you, we're kind of waiting. You know, we're waiting for the government to do it for us. We're waiting for our parents to do it for us. We're waiting for God. We're waiting for something outside of ourselves, or we're waiting for the heroes to kind of change our world or our reality. And for me, it hit me many years ago, literally just who? I was in a room. I remember being mad at the world, mad at God, miserable, filled with a sense of entitlement, like God should do it for me. My father should support me. And I was angry, to be honest, because I had nothing and I was frustrated. And I felt like, if my father supported me and I'm being a good person, I'm doing yoga, I'm meditating, and why is my life not working out? You know, and I realized, number one, hey, cool. You are so ungrateful and you are full of entitlement. And one thing I had to give up was the sense that someone owes me something. This idea that the world owes me something. And I remember having to give that up and realize no one's coming. No one is going to show up at my doorstep. It was an epiphany in that moment, in the depth of, you could say, my frustration. Oprah's not going to show up at my doorstep and discover me. You know, no one's going to show up at my doorstep and give me $1 million and build my business for me. No one's going to show up and like go to the gym and go jogging and lose 20 pounds for me. For anyone, I'm going to have to do it.
That's so sad. That one would be awesome.
Wouldn't that be great?
Right? Oh my God.
We could create an app and someone says, okay, I would like you to go jogging for me and I'm going to lose the 20 pounds. That would be $1 billion business right there.
Oh my God. I could watch them sweat and sweat just comes off my body. I mean, how amazing would that be, right? So nobody's coming to save us.
No one's coming. And I realized that. And I realized, look, Buddha is dead. Bob Marley, Muhammad Ali, Bruce Lee, you know, Gandhi, MLK, JFK, Mother Teresa, they're gone. And the reality is I'm here, you're here, we're here, and we're here for a reason. So basically, it's an invitation. That phrase, no one's coming, is simply, it's not morbid, like, oh, no one's coming, you're screwed. It's an invitation to realize that it's you. You've been given everything. I've been given everything. Everything we need right now inside of us, there is a living, breathing life force, energy, whatever you want to call it. The same force that brought existence into creation, the same force that is lighting up the sun and bringing up the moon and functioning 7 billion people and all the species and breathing your heart, my heart, everything, doing all of this, is the same force that is living us right now. We are living, breathing miracles. And in essence, I believe we've been given everything we need. And I think part of it is we have to own that. And sometimes to own who we are, to own our greatness, to own our power is a little scary, because we don't really have any more excuses once we own the truth of who we are, once we own how powerful we really are as souls, and those excuses are gone. So I think it's simply an invitation to remember and own you're the one, it's you. And greatness isn't something that's just bestowed upon you, but greatness is what you are. And it's a moment-to-moment choice that we have to make, and we have the power.
But you also talk about how we get trapped in a prison of fake success, right? That we are like down the road, we didn't make the choice you made, right? Like there's a lot of people out there who are listening who took the job, who sold out because they didn't want to lose the love of a parent, or they didn't want to risk being seen or not accepted. And you say that we have to peel back to perfect, and kids are perfect, and they start off with this clean slate. So what happens? How do we go from this clean slate kid to suddenly being trapped in this prison of fake success? And then how do we get back out?
Yeah, I think, you know, I believe that what we are, you know, is this pure essence. As you mentioned, if you look at a child that's born you look into a child's eyes, they are so in touch with the infinite, God, the divine, whatever you want to call it. They are in touch with that pure essence, consciousness of life that is just moving through them. A child will jump on the table and sing and shout and laugh and dance. It's not thinking, oh, do you like my singing? Or can I sing? Am I fat? You know, it's just expressing itself. It's life expressing itself. And I think we all were like that once at some stage before we met our parents and our grandparents and before we slowly started to get conditioned by society and media with rules and stuff and pain, trauma, hurt, abuse. Maybe our parents weren't really around. Maybe they hurt us. Maybe they abandoned us. Just stuff happened. Maybe there were breakups and heartaches and divorce. So all of a sudden we came in these bright, wide open beings and then we start dealing with certain challenges of life and personalities and parents. And slowly it was painful. So slowly we start learning all sorts of mechanisms, strategies, and ways to disconnect from feeling the pain, often unconsciously. And we start developing all sorts of protection mechanisms to not feel the pain of, you know, our parents not loving us a certain way or being there for us a certain way or the divorce or whatever it was that was going on. And we start learning mechanisms, strategies to disconnect, not feel, to protect our sensitivity, to protect our heart. And then as a result, layer upon layer upon layer builds up, 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 layer builds up. And that light, that essence kind of gets a little, I think, buried underneath all those layers that we've started to suppress and disconnect from in an effort to not feel. And then we also go out into the world and we start learning this sense of who do I need to be in order for you to love me? Who do I need to be in order for my dad to love me? Well, if I'm the nice person or if I'm the sweet person, if I'm the yes person or if I'm always helping, or we start learning all sorts of, again, survival, ultimately strategies, mechanisms to function, to survive, to get love, to fit in, to be approved, to be validated. And we develop a mask, we develop a persona, we develop a way of being that gets us the love, the validation that we think we want, you know, from our parents. And as a result, we become this person, this persona, this character, in a sense of avoiding pain and getting love and approval and validation. We become this personality, this character, and we think this is who we really are, not really realizing that often it's really a... we're living out an unconscious programmed way of being that has come about as a result of conditioning in response to trying to just function and survive. So I like to ask people the question, who are you really? You know, and to be willing to realize that who you think you are may not be who you really are, but it's really who you've been conditioned to be. So I think what we have to start doing first is questioning. We have to start questioning, who am I? We have to start also questioning who we think we are and be willing to let go, because most of the time we're not even really aware of the fact that we're conditioned.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and this was me. I mean, I took this job and it wasn't for me, and I layered and layered and layered. And one of the things I realized as I started to peel back these layers and get back to myself was that I couldn't really tell the difference between the true me and the false me.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And the real thing that totally threw me is I realized the thoughts in my head, the ones that I had trusted to be me, they sound like me. They have my voice. They use my cadence. They like actually use my vocabulary. They don't sound like, you know, all these layers that we've used from other people. So how do you suggest somebody starts to find that, you know, distinction between the real self and this self that they've created?
I think first we have to just acknowledge and just become aware that we are conditioned. And then I think we have to start in becoming, investigating that conditioning. And for me, what I did was I started looking at my conditioning, and I started to explore my conditioning. I started to explore my childhood. I started to really question what I believed, question what I thought, questioned who I thought I was. And I just started to literally question and ask myself, is that true? Do I really believe that? Can I know that for sure? Is that really what I feel? And there was so much that I wasn't even aware of that I took on from my parents, from my father, from my childhood, that wasn't really what I believed. It was just kind of what I was told, and I took it on. So I think we have to become aware that we're conditioned and start questioning ourselves and have the courage to then let go. To me, awareness is the first step to transformation, you know. And I think sometimes how we know perhaps we're stuck is we may feel a level of pain. or we might feel we are repeating certain patterns over and over and over and over and over again. And if we feel pain, I think the pain is a signal that is often showing us where we're maybe not as present, where we're maybe not as conscious. And I think that can lead to us dealing with our conditioning, you know. And I think where we can also feel where we don't have as much freedom, you know, maybe, oh God, I feel so much love, but it's not coming out, or in certain situations, I'm not fully being myself. You know, I'm not able to, like, I go to a party and I don't feel I can fully express myself, or I hide in certain situations, or I don't speak the truth. Where we feel those limits on expression, those limits on loving, where we feel the flow isn't happening, I think that gives us a clue to, perhaps there's a reason. Perhaps there's somewhere that is as a result of my conditioning that I need to look at. It's not simply, this is who I am. You know, it's not simply, that's just, I give you a quick analogy. Many years ago, I had a client who I worked with, and just to cut the story short, when I first met him, I saw him to be a complete, like, he was so powerful, but the way he showed up was so kind of victim-y and shy and quiet. And I looked at him and I said, you're a lion and you're acting like a mouse. And he kept holding on to this sense of like, no, cool. I'm just a quiet person. I'm just a shy person. I'm just, you know, he married a very outgoing woman who did all the talking, and he could kind of hide behind there. And she was the front person. He was the behind the scenes person. And he kept telling everyone, it's just me. I love supporting people. I love being in the background. I love being, you know, the supporter, which on some level there was a gift there. It was true. But on another level, I saw so much power and energy and ferocity inside of this man that wasn't being expressed and unleashed and given to the world. And so his whole identity was, I'm just quiet. I'm just shy. And so as I started working with him, to cut long story short, as I started working with him, I asked him a couple of questions. 24 hours after asking him some of those questions, I don't even remember what they were, but we just have an exploration about some of his childhood and some of how he got to be who he was. He came to me with tears in his eyes. And not to get too heavy here, but I remember him saying, could I have been crying for 24 hours? I haven't cried. I'm 55. I haven't cried in 50 years. And he said, Coot, I had a memory when I was age 5 where I was molested by my uncle. And I didn't even remember this. I wasn't conscious that this even happened to me. Oh. I was sexually molested by my uncle. And I didn't even know until just I started to dig a little deeper, and I felt safe to explore and then feel certain feelings. And I remembered what happened. And he goes, everything makes sense. You see, what had happened for this guy, for my client, was as a young kid, he was bright, he was loud, he was fully expressed, he was engaged, he was radiant, he was magnificent. And this thing happened, this event happened that really shouldn't have happened. It wasn't okay. It just this thing happened with his uncle, and it shouldn't have happened. And as a result, unconsciously, it wasn't a conscious decision, he made up as a young kid, as a 5-year-old kid, it's not safe to be seen. Mm-hmm. It's not safe. When I'm seen, when I'm expressive, when I'm bright, when I'm big, when I'm magnificent, bad things happen.
Yeah.
So unconsciously, his protection mechanism was, if I hide, if you can't see me, you can't hurt me. And then he created a persona, a way of being in the world, which was to hide, to not be seen, to be the background person, married a wife that was the front person, and you could never hurt him because he was never really seen. He was never really front, stage, and center. And as a result, he was never really able to take his business to the next level, because obviously if you're going to be successful in the world to a degree, you're going to have to be seen. And so there was this sort of unconscious conflict inside of him. So I think he wasn't aware of that. He just thought, and he convinced himself, this is who I am. So I just invite everyone to ask him, just begin by asking, is who I am where I really am? Is it who I really am? Who am I really? And begin that process, you know, of inquiring. And what will often happen is there's so many feelings and emotions that we've learned to suppress to keep our mechanism, our personas, our identities, our protection mechanisms in place, that part of the healing is we have to be willing to feel a lot of the feelings that we've learned to suppress and not feel, that we haven't dealt with, that we've avoided. And I think if we feel them, we can heal them, we can release them, we can let them go.
And I love everything you're saying. And I think one thing that's really hitting me is this idea that, right, we We have to move into the pain. We see these signals in our life that we're avoiding, and we don't feel free. We don't feel open at a cocktail party, as you mentioned, or whatever the situation is. But this question of feeling safe to explore for somebody out there that's saying, yeah, you know what? That's me. I'm not comfortable at a cocktail party. I have all this pain. I know it's in my body, but I feel like if I turn inward, if I start to face it, I'm going to fall apart because I've put this together so carefully, right? What do you say to the person that has so much fear about exploring their self and this idea that they'll fall apart?
You know, I think sometimes it does take a lot of courage to explore. Let's just acknowledge that it takes a lot of courage to explore.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage to feel. It takes a lot of courage to go inside. It takes a lot of courage to unravel some of those mechanisms and the ways that we've learned to protect ourselves. And I think we can honor those identities and those aspects of ourselves that they worked when we were 5 and they worked when we were 7 and they worked when we were 8 and 10 and 16. But, you know, at a certain point, they may have been a little outdated now and they might be getting in the way of our full expression. So I think first we have to honor them and honor those parts of ourselves, honor the positive intention of those parts because they were trying to get us something positive. It's just the way they were going about it was a little limiting because now we're restricted. Now we're not fully expressed because if we're afraid, if I fully express, then I'm going to get hurt. Then it's going to be painful. Then it's going to be something bad's going to happen. So we have to, I think, first honor that, but also realize, yes, it takes courage, but realize that no feelings, if we're willing to open up just in stages, you know, we can be gentle with ourselves and compassionate with ourselves in the process. It doesn't have to just be one big explosion. It's a process, it's a lifetime process. You know, I would say returning to wholeness. I think if we can realize that no feelings will last forever. And if we're willing to hold ourselves with compassion, hold ourselves with tenderness, hold ourselves with gentleness, and be willing to feel those feelings just in stages. No feeling is permanent. No feeling that we open up will last forever. I think all feelings that we feel with intention in a conscious and healthy way will also at some point have to dissolve as we work through them. And I think sometimes there's a fear of if I feel this, then it's going to be forever and it may fall apart. And what I found is sometimes it's also okay, and this is kind of a little counter, but it's also okay to let things that no longer are working to fall apart. It doesn't have to be, I think, earth-shattering, although it might be, but I think it's all about how we hold ourselves. And I think if we hold ourselves with love and compassion and create a safe space for ourselves to do that, then I think it can set us up to win.
Yeah. You know?
But I think when we realize no feelings we feel will last forever. They will never go on forever. They will pass. And I think if we're willing to do that, then on the other side, because we also have to realize that in living how we're living, which is kind of suppressing these things to keep everything in place, we're not really living. We're not really fully alive. You know, we're not maybe 30% of who we are, maybe 50%, maybe 40%, but we're not fully alive, fully expressed. So I think what's on the other side is the possibility for a tremendous amount of joy and creativity and aliveness and love if we're willing to walk the process. But yes, it does take courage.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does take courage to face oneself and to be who you really are takes courage. But I would say and feel that the rewards of that authentic life are truly worth it.
And if we have layered these things on top of ourselves over a lifetime, then we're still there. We're still underneath it. So even if you turn in and it feels like you have this monsoon of emotion, you're always there. You're always intact, right? There's the part of you that it's not lost. It's not broken. It just needs to be uncovered.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
I think
you finish the book with this wonderful set of sentences that you peel back the layers. So you're set free, free to love, free to be yourself, rise up, and you say surrender. And I wanted to hit you up on the question of surrender because I feel like I love this word. It was something that I embraced about 10 years ago. I thought it meant to give up. And I love that you put the idea of surrender and then you say, step into the game. Why surrender first and then step in? Because so many people think of that as sort of a weak space to surrender. Like I'm in a war and that's the side that lost.
Yeah, I think to surrender is to open yourself to life. And I think surrender is to let go of the control that you think you have. You know, the control that you think you have over your life and your destiny. And I mean, there's a level of control that we can control kind of what we eat and certain things. But for me, there is a whole intelligence of creation, life that is living all of existence, that's living and breathing us. Life was way, it was here before you and I were here. It's here now, and it will be here when you and I are gone.
Yeah.
And so I think when we realize what it is that's actually living all of this, and I think the real freedom is when we let go of control, the control that we think we have, and we open ourselves to what it is that is seeking to happen. Because the mind sometimes thinks it knows, and the mind sometimes thinks it knows what's best for us, but the mind itself is conditioned. The mind itself, no matter how brilliant, has its limitations. But I've always felt that the soul is infinite. What we really are, the pure consciousness of our being, is infinite. It knows. There is an intelligence there because it is part of consciousness. It is part of everything. So there is an intelligence there. And I think the more we're able to go beyond the mind and let go, that doesn't mean we can't have intention. But I think sometimes we can get so attached to our goals and attached to our intention, attached to making things happen that we think have to be a certain way, that we think should be a certain way. And the reality is, based on our limitedness, we can't see the totality of life, the totality of this whole existence. But there is intelligence in our souls. I think the more we can surrender to that. And to me, part of surrender is saying, okay, I would like this to happen because that's what feels authentic. But I'm open to the highest good. I'm open and I invite the highest good that's seeking to happen. Then truly allow ourselves to be open. And I think that's where we take the limits off of life. And that's where we bring ourselves into a flow where life can move through us and miracles happen. And many times things will unfold then in our lives because there's less resistance, there's less limits inside of us in a way that blows us away, in a way that is even better than we can even imagine. You know, so I think to me, surrender has been a key. If I look at anyone great, if I look at the Gandhis of the world, if I look at the Jesuses of the world, if I look at the Buddhas of the world, if I look at the Mother Teresas of the world, if I look at the Martin Luther Kings of the world, if I look at people that really, you know, move humanity in a sense of greatness, to me, they were all living surrender. They were living. That was the secret. Gandhi couldn't do what he did. And I'm not saying we all have to do that, but Gandhi couldn't do what he did if it was just his own personal power.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King couldn't just do what he did if it was just his own personal power. Mother Teresa couldn't just do what she did based on her personal power because the persona has its limitations. Mm. But what is living us is an infinite stream of energy that is life. And when we surrender to that, then the game shifts from simply, what do I want? What do I want with my life? I want this. I want that. I don't. And it's great. I mean, you might get the car and the house and what have you. And it's great. But what does life want? What does life want to express through me? What is life seeking to express through me? And then you go from like holding a little cup to a huge lake. Your receptivity expands. And then you are lived. And that's when I've seen in my life, when I get myself out of the way, miracles happen, miracles flow, miracles unfold, you know. And I think when we live in that place, then we can trust the nature of life, trust existence. And I think it's a much more graceful way to live rather than trying to control everything and make everything happen and force everything in so much stress. And it's like life is unfolding. You know, and I think we have to show up say yes, show up, do our part, take action, do our absolute best, but live in surrender from the beginning. Because then we're open, you know, then we're truly open to the magic. If we're not open, no, I surrender, but not this, not this. I surrender, but not this, not this, not this, and not this. Well, that's not really surrender, you know?
right. And that's, you know, this is the message we've all learned is, you know, you say rise up and everybody gets that part. It's like, I'm going to rise up. I'm going to step forward. I'm going to push harder. I'm going to work more hours. But this piece of surrendering and letting also the world present itself to you is such a huge piece of the game. And you speak so beautifully to that. So one of the things that I ask everybody who comes on the show, it's called The Art of Authenticity. And I'm going to ask you is, what does an authentic life then mean to you?
I think an authentic life simply is when you are living the truth of who you are, when you are living the truth of your essence, your feeling, your heart, as much as you can, moment to moment to moment in the world. To me, that's an authentic life. When you're just living who you really are and being who you really are, it may not be perfect. To me, it's not about perfection. But when you're being yourself, at least as much of yourself that you have access to in this moment, right now.
That's so beautiful.
And you're sharing that best you can. And the level of authenticity may grow 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Just keep expanding, you know?
Absolutely. I love that. That's beautiful. And so I also ask guests, what do you do? Because the myth out there is that I find an authentic life, and you just said it beautifully that 5 years, you may have more access to more authenticity. How do you stay on the path of an authentic life, right? Like, do you have any practices or habits, or during a difficult decision day to day, what are some things you can share to help grow that connection to your authentic self and therefore stay on a path that feels authentic?
I mean, there's a few things, but one of the things that just popped up is really practicing and cultivating awareness. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I didn't realize until this moment, but I think Krishnamurti talks about, you know, awareness a lot and moment to moment awareness. And that's something that's really impacted me is because many times when we're not aware, I think there's so much of life in our culture and our society, especially now that's so busy, that's constantly distracting us, you know, constant distractions. And it's so easy to get distracted. And then when we get distracted, it's easy to get disconnected from our hearts, from the truth of our own authenticity, of our feeling, of our truth. And that's when it's easy to kind of go unconscious and go to sleep. And before you know it, a month goes by, a week goes by, a year goes by. It's like, how did I get here? You know, who did I become?
Yeah.
And I think we have to be really aware and vigilant in our awareness and practice that moment to moment awareness. Basically, I'm saying we must stay awake.
Yeah.
We must stay consciously awake and cultivate the moment-to-moment presence and awareness, moment-to-moment, so that we don't just go asleep. Because it's so easy in the gravity of the West to go to sleep because there's so many triggers and so much of our media is designed to make us to fall asleep. Because if we can fall asleep and forget who we are and lose touch with our authentic heart and nature, then it's easy for us to get sold a bunch of stuff, you know, in the world and thinking, well, we get sold this idea, you're not enough. We lose touch with the authenticity. And then, well, if you just, you know, wear this dress or buy this thing or drink this beer, then you'll be enough. But I think when we cultivate that moment-to-moment awareness and we stay present with our experience, we stay present with ourselves and we be in a constant state of inquiry, you know, and questioning. One of the things that I do to practice that is quite simple. You know, is I meditate, that really helps me. But the other thing is a simple practice of just asking myself, where is my attention right now? Where is my attention right now? And sometimes I will say, oh my God, my attention is, where the hell did my attention go? It was gone for an hour, you know? And so I think the more we can be aware of, oh, where's my attention was floating somewhere. Okay, bring it back to this, to my heart, bring it back to this moment. Where is my attention? Like, okay, bring it back. And to have the attention centered in the heart, you know, I think is very powerful and it's been a key for me.
Incredible. I just loved your book. I think anybody out there listening should grab a copy. If somebody's looking for your book, more information about you, where can they find it?
Oh, thank you. A couple of places. I would say would love for everyone to check out the book. It's a love letter from my heart to the world. You can find it at You Are The One, simply youaretheonebook.com. And when you buy it there, there's incredible, some great videos and giveaways, things we're giving away as free gifts. You can go also to my websites. I have a couple, cootblackson.com. Find out about my work there. And one of my favorite events I do around the world is boundlessblissbali.com. And you can find out about stuff there and also videos on social media and come hang out. It'd be great to connect with everyone.
Thank you so much for coming on The Art of Authenticity. I know that I enjoyed this interview. I'm confident everybody listening will. And I really appreciate all the work you're doing for everybody on this subject.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a joy, and I really felt your heart a lot today. So it's just great to be with you.
Thank you.